when I listen back to myself on the podcast, I'm like, oh, do I sound like that? But I'm like, this is what people sound like. This is how people talk.
Hi, welcome to the Vocal Fries podcast, the podcast about linguistic discrimination.
I'm Megan Figueroa.
And I'm Carrie Gillen.
How you doing, Carrie?
I'm feeling pretty good. Yeah. How about you?
Good. Yeah. I went a couple of weeks there without any air conditioning, and now I have air conditioning.
I don't know how you could do it. I mean, I know it's slightly cooler in Tucson, but not enough
cooler. No, not enough cooler. It was miserable. My poor dog found, like, all of the different ways to lay on the tile to cool himself. Mm-hmm. Poor guy. It's like, right there with him laying on the ground. Like, this has got to be the best way. But now we have air conditioning.
Yay!
It's funny because, darn it, I don't remember who it was on Twitter, but they said that they couldn't believe last week, or 2 weeks ago, when we were talking about how hot it gets here, how they just couldn't fathom it. And yes, it's kind of a, until you experience it yourself, you don't quite understand.
You don't. I remember the very first day I arrived here in August, and I was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? And I had to take the bus and go to Social Security building so that I could get a Social Security number. Like, I had to start from scratch, right? And I was like dying.
Anyway, I feel like right now during these times, we either only have weather or COVID to talk about.
Yeah. And speaking of COVID.
Yes. Oh, segue.
Really, really nice segue.
Thank you.
The Académie Française, remember, well, so in our bonus episode, we actually mentioned that there is a French Academy that monitors the French language. The Académie Française has deemed COVID to be, I believe, masculine.
And this is grammatical gender.
Grammatical gender, yes, obviously.
Yes, yes.
It can't possibly be the other one.
I mean.
Can't be biological or whatever. Anyway, our former guest, two-time guest, Andrew McKenzie, actually points out that he had noted this before the Academy has said anything. Odd linguistic quirk. In France, it's le COVID-19. And then in Quebec, it's la COVID-19. It's interesting because he points out that it's le coronavirus. Sorry for my accent there. Because it's le virus. Le virus? I don't know. But COVID, because it's an English acronym, it's almost always le in France.
Le is the masculine pronoun?
Determiner, yes.
The L-E.
Yeah, le is masculine, la is the feminine. So, so it's le COVID because almost all English acronyms are treated as masculine in French. France, French. But in Quebec, they have a tendency to unpack the acronyms, figure out what the French equivalent would be for the words in the acronym, and then assign the correct gender for it. So, in COVID, the D stands for disease, and that's la maladie in French. Le COVID in France and la COVID in Quebec.
That is really interesting.
Yeah, it's fun.
So is it all acronyms that are borrowed or just English ones in France that they give the...
I don't know. I just said only English, but I don't actually know if that's the case.
Yeah. Hmm. Huh.
Oh, so actually I got this wrong. So actually the Académie Française is saying, no, it should be feminine. It should be la.
What?
Because of the la maladie.
Like they're saying in Quebec.
So they're saying the Québécois are correct. Just kind of fun.
Ah, even though screw academies of languages telling everyone how to speak.
Right. But it's kind of interesting that they're choosing.
Yeah.
A regional dialect that they don't often agree with.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's kind of fun.
Huh. Now that's shocking to me.
Me too. That's why I got it backwards in my head, because I was like, there's no way they would agree with Quebec.
Or is it one way to say, screw you, English?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I have no idea what it is in Spanish. Let us know. Let us know what it is in other languages.
Yeah, I would love to. I would love to hear any language that makes some any kind of grammatical gender distinction, or anything. Like, what if you have an animacy distinction, like Algonquin languages?
Yeah,
is a virus animate or inanimate?
My heart tells me it's animate, but my heart is not that language.
Today's episode, we talk with two women who work either for or with the Unconscious Bias Project, and we talk about unconscious bias and all kinds of things. It's really an interesting conversation, so
enjoy.
Like this show and want to make your own? Let me tell you about Anchor. It's free, and they have creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And now you can even add any song from Spotify directly to your episodes. The possibilities are endless for what you can create, whether it's music analysis, your own radio show, or something the world's never heard before. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. And you can also make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
So today we have with us Dr. Lynette Mehra, the executive director and co-founder of the Unconscious Bias Project. She is a changemaker, scientist, and artist from Colombia who develops and implements diversity, equity, and inclusion-focused programs by assessing community needs, leveraging existing resources, and cultivating collaborations within and between organizations. While completing her PhD at UC San Francisco, she co-developed and ran the graduate division's first annual interactive diversity workshop for PhD students and faculty as part of the Minority Graduate Students Organization. We also have with us Lucretia Iruela. Lucretia is the founder of Meliora, a coaching firm for organizations and individuals. She is a senior human resources consultant and a leadership coach in multiple countries. She provides support to executives, leaders, business owners, and entities in navigating opportunities within their professional roles. She is also a facilitator and advisor for the Unconscious Bias Project. The Unconscious Bias Project is developing creative, community-based bias reduction online programs grounded in proven methods to reduce unintentional bias, which is to be launched in May and June.
So welcome.
Yes, welcome. Thank you so much for being
here with us.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm so excited to be on here. Like, I love your podcast. It's hilarious. You have such great people invited, and I just feel like, oh my gosh, I don't know, like a little bit starstruck, like, whoa, like a huge podcast, wow.
Well, now you're part of the great people that we invite onto this show.
Thank you.
And actually, UBP ran two awesome workshops with my Vocal Fry clips at the California Welfare Directors Association last year.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. Will you just say a little bit about that? What was the purpose of it?
Yeah. So the purpose of the clips, of why we included the clips. So let me give you a short thing about the California Welfare Directors Association. So this is a nonprofit that helps and supports California welfare directors, meaning everybody that runs things from child services, family services, food, welfare, like all of those things. You know, these are people that are running really big programs like all over California. So we're talking about, millions of Californians that we're supporting. And they have an annual meeting where they try to, teach these directors like the latest and greatest, get them together, do some team building, things like that. And we were so happy to be invited to run a series. So we ran a series for them. We had a huge, 100 plus people panel discussion. We ran a couple regular workshops. We ran a fun shop. And we realized that when we were delivering our bias reduction tools and, you know, content about bias, we were thinking really hard about how their employees are interacting with other people. And if you think about it, what's the first thing you're going to do if you need help? You're going to call somebody, right? You know, it's usually a phone call or you have an in-person interview. And like that first phone call can really make or break decisions about your welfare. So when I learned about your podcast and I started listening to it and thinking about it, I was like, oh my gosh, this is so important. We haven't really covered like linguistic discrimination, like, you know, that, you know, unconscious bias, implicit bias. People often talk about it as like an in-person thing. You know, you hear about, you know, cops and their like split second decision and how they interact with somebody that they suspect might have a gun that goes really wrong, but it can also go really wrong in like a straight up conversation. And so I had a chance to talk to Carrie a little bit about there's so many aspects of like linguistics and linguistic discrimination. And I was like, well, you know, here's a really easy example is how the person, you know, say I'm a social services person, I'm fielding a call from somebody that's seeking my services. And, you know, this person sounds, you know, quote unquote young, right? Has a lot of vocal fry, has like the up tilt at the end of sentences. And I'm like, you know, this person's not, you know, very experienced. You know, I don't know. You know, maybe they don't really know how to look for services or something. You know, you can make like that split second decision, even if you have a script going. And so we presented the vocal fry in the context of, okay, you know, listen to this clip. Think about, okay, who is this person? You know, are they younger? Are they older? Are they educated? Are they uneducated? Have they finished college? Would you think they're competent or not? And then we went to the next slide, and then it was a picture of Megan. And it's like, look at this. Look at this, a PhD. She runs a podcast. She's very accomplished. And, you know, just to sort of like, you know, juxtapose those two, you know, your preconceived notion and then what you actually see. And those sort of like active learning examples is what we love to do in our workshops to, you know, confront people with your own bias. Lots of people are like, yes, bias is bad. Bias is terrible. We don't want to be, you know, discriminatory. We don't want to be racist, sexist, or whatever is, right? But as soon as you catch yourself doing it, then you're like, oh, crap. Like I'm in this too. And, you know, so that's what we used your amazing clip for that is to have people sort of catch themselves. And it was really fun. I beta tested the slides with my team and they were like, oh, whoa. Yeah, I definitely, I realized I had that preconceived notion, you know, and we're the ones that are teaching this stuff. We still have those biases too. We can make those split second decisions, but it's catching that moment of like, oh, I just categorize this person without knowing, you know, a single thing about them that is so important.
There are some biases that are harder to catch, right? Will you tell us a little bit about what unconscious bias is?
So if we take a step back, what is bias? So bias is prejudice in favor of or against one thing, person, or group compared with another, usually in a way considered to be unfair. And unconscious bias is when you're having these biases, these unfair judgments of other people or other groups without really realizing you're doing it. So, you know, a really easy example is, you know, say you see me leading a workshop and I'm like, okay, everybody, you know, put your pencils down or whatever. And you're like, oh gosh, she's so bossy, always telling me what to do. Really wouldn't think that if it was a guy. You're like, oh yes, he's such a good leader. He's directing us properly, right? That's a really simple one, right? And it's very easy to have because there's stereotypes all around us that are really feeding into and like building our unconscious biases against different groups. It can come from TV, movies, podcasts, radio, books, anything on the internet. Your friends, your family, even strangers, like how you see other people behaving with other people, that all reinforces the, you know, really terrible stereotypes that are out there for all sorts of people. And you can be biased against your own group, So I can be biased against Latina women. Like that is the thing that happens. And Black people can be biased against Black people. I mean, it's the way it is. It's unfortunate. But the more we're able to recognize and catch it, the more we can actually do something about it.
How do we measure it, if we can?
That's a really good question. I'll take a step back. So unconscious bias and the way we measured it really started with this implicit association test. Or it didn't start with implicit association test, but it sort of blew up once the implicit association test came around. The implicit association test was developed by scientists Greenwald, McGee, and Schwartz back in 1998. And there's all sorts of really great articles and reviews about it. And I really encourage people to seek that out. And what they wanted to do was to try to measure, like, how can you know that you're having this unconscious bias decision if people consciously don't want to be biased? And so what they try to do is to measure like split second associations people had with a different group. For example, are you associating men with science and women with liberal arts, for example? And you do this really quick test, and they're really fun, actually, online tests that you can take. If you could just go to, you could just Google IAT or implicit association test. There's lots of these different tests you can take online.
And they're pretty eye-opening.
Yes, they're really eye-opening. However, and yeah, so usually you'll be able to see some sort of bias, regardless of who you are. There's not that many people that don't have some sort of bias. The controversy in the field now is that it's not as be-all, end-all type of a test. So you can't just be like, okay, I scored a 10, for example. I mean, that's not an actual measure on it. But I scored a 10 out of 10. I'm like super biased. So if I take some bias reductions, you know, workshops or whatever, and then I come back and if it's a 5 out of 10, well, then I'm so much better. So there's actually a lot of noise in the test. It's not absolutely perfect. But, you know, the original authors still think it's a good way to look at whether or not you have a tendency. So they're not like, you know, just take the number and that's your number. It's more like, and, you know, it's not like taking a, you know, temperature or something. It's more like, you know, are you trending towards one direction or the other? So there's neuroscientists that have also tried to look at, you know, this unconscious bias or, you know, split second bias by looking at in-group and out-group people. So in-group, so for example, Lucrecia and I, you know, and Megan would belong to the in-group of like Latina women. That would be our in-group. And then if, for example, there was a white guy, he would be in my out-group. So they're not in my in-group. And so they're trying to measure like people's empathy like within their in-group or towards people in an out-group by Dr. David Eagleman. And there's this really fun PBS video series on this that's really interesting to look at. And they found that there's the parts of the brain that you associate with empathy light up for people that are in your in-group, but they don't for people that are in your out-group. So there are different ways to look at it. Nothing is absolutely perfect. It's actually a really interesting field. There's people looking at unconscious bias. So if you think about Black Lives Matter and the really, you know, tragedy of so many young Black men dying because of this sort of ingrained bias. There's been a few studies out there where they use like video games, for example, or like, you know, in person, you know, blank shots where you have to like shoot, you know, with high accuracy and speed, you know, whoever is, you know, popping out on your screen with a gun. And, you know, you can show the bias there, right? I think this is pretty much everywhere in the news right now. But yeah, there is some controversy in the field of like, well, is it really unconscious bias or is it just like overt bias, but we're just calling it unconscious to make people feel better?
I was working with a group and that is called Inclusive Inc. And they do kind of like a 360 about culture and bias in the workplace. So they really give you examples of your own behavior when you are not treating people the same in the same circumstances. And it's a little bit tricky because you can really see real examples of yourself, but it's out there and it's a tool that, you know, some companies are utilizing. Every time that I listen to Lynette, I feel that is, you know, the best of the best in terms of knowledge and expertise in this field. They like the topic. They really know the topic. The way that I utilize the really high level definition and high level description, when I coach teams or individuals, and I coach a lot in large corporations in the Bay Area, so you can imagine, you can name it. It's very confidential, but if you think big, you will get it. It's the filter that we have before each interaction or any interaction. It's sometimes for me, it's very delicate to use prejudices or prejudgment or even association, right? Because immediately our brain is like, no, that's not me. So when I use filter, it's like, what is your filter right now before you made that comment? Because they made the comments to me and I need to deconstruct that comment. What is the comment coming from? Have you noticed your filter? People are way more open to observe or to be more aware of themselves and their circumstances are, as Lynette said, what is this coming from? It's coming from your family, your culture, your literature, your friends. What is this coming from? So I like to use it that way.
Can you give me an example of a comment that has been given to you that where you needed to have this conversation of what's your filter?
A lot of times the managers, when they're really white collar, they say sometimes to the blue collar, and they're usually foreigners, they don't work hard, they don't get it, they don't understand. And you need to change the perspective. What is working hard for you? What is the things that you feel them, they don't get it? Are you really talking to them? Are you really listening to them? Like, no, I don't listen to them. I just tell them what to do and why. Why you are not listening to them or talking to them. So they, little by little, they realize I am not the same with them. I am different.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot. And I have to say, I've enjoyed working with Lucrecia because she thinks so deeply about these things. And our work at Unconscious Bias Project and the work that Lucrecia does as an executive coach, it's all really about empathy, right? Seeing things from the other person's perspective and how can you talk to them, right? You know, if you tell somebody outright, hey, you're sexist, you're racist, they're not going to listen. You know, it's they immediately shut down. This has been proven. I mean, I'm a scientist, so I totally geek out on papers and data. But people have studied this a lot, especially in politics, like for canvassing. There's some really great resources out there. If you're listening to this and you're the kind of person that wants to convince somebody that what they're doing, what they're saying, what they're posting is wrong, you don't start with the confrontation. You have to start with like the empathy. And there's if you search like canvassing tools, I think there is a whole series on YouTube about like when we were trying to get gay marriage approved. You know, how do you talk to voters that don't think that gay marriage is right? Like, how do you talk to them? And it's really building that empathy. Like, you don't just say, "Hi, I'm gay," and you know, please vote for gay marriage. You ask them, okay, you know, what is your stance? What are you thinking? And then, you know, if they're obviously against gay marriage, then you ask them like, oh, have you, you know, ever had this experience of being othered? Right? You just start from that basic connection. And once you know, you can understand like, oh yeah, it's a situation about being othered. It's a situation about being bullied, being unjustly, you know, accused or unfairly treated. You know, whether you call it a filter or, you know, a preconceived notion, an unconscious bias, or, I mean, you know, the reality is like, it's systemic, it's institutional, it's ingrained in our culture, it's ingrained in like history in so many countries, right? So You start from there of like, you know, shared empathy of like, oh yeah, this is unfair. Then people are more likely to come around.
I have read some of that stuff, and it is really interesting to see the tactics that actually do work. Because it's true, like I think for many of us, our first reaction is, oh my God, that's so sexist. Oh my God, that's so racist. But people's defenses definitely go up. Mine included. Like, it's just kind of a natural thing to want to defend yourself. So it is important for us to be more strategic. In this podcast, we definitely are not strategic because we're just yelling at people all the time. So first, Lynette, why did you want to start this? And then Lucretia maybe can say why she wanted to work with you.
So I'm from Colombia, and I grew up in 5 different countries. I grew up in Nigeria, France, Venezuela, the States, and in Colombia, of course. And I, as a little kid, I had no idea. I didn't really think that people were different from me. I didn't realize that. And even though in Colombia, like, racism is so strong, and I'm actually the lightest person in my family. Like, you see my extended family, and there are all the colors. And I'm one of the palest ones. So I now understand, right, after being in the US for a while, that I'm what people consider white passing. But that didn't stop me from getting bullied or othered. And that happened to me in middle school, where I got bullied. And I was othered in Colombia, actually, because I spoke English well without a Colombian accent. I was othered for, you know, liking school. You know, when I landed.
Same.
right. Like, nerds unite. Yay. Yeah, power to the nerd.
Yes.
But when I landed in the US, you know, this is still at a time, I mean, it's still kind of like this, but it was at a time where this idea of like Colombia as like the center for drugs, like that was all anybody knew about Colombians. The center for drugs. You know, I arrived in the States in high school, and we were in Texas. So like, whoa. One of the first things I remember ever when I told somebody I was from Colombia, and I had an American accented English because I'd just been in an American school. They were like, oh, does your dad deal cocaine? Can I get some? And that was a joke to them. And I was furious because I had seen in Colombia, like, the kind of violence. I knew, like, I already knew that, like, you know, the drug trade was really being fueled by consumers in the States. You know, I just, it was terrible. And so when I went to college, I tried to, you know, hey, you know, let's get to know each other as part of like international student associations. You know, I realized, like, what we needed is a way to talk to each other and find like commonalities and share something. And actually, so Texas, right? So if we remember back when I was in college, which was a while ago, this was not too far after 9/11. And Texas, in particular, there was a lot of anti-Muslim, anti-Brown sentiment at the time. When I was in college, this really, really stood out when there were students that were driving up behind people at night. So people with turbans and hitting them with baseball bats in the head and driving off. So it was like, it was random, not random, but like hate crimes, really acts of violence. What we know, what we called now hate crimes. Back then it was like, oh, things are happening. You should just walk in groups so you're not, you know, in danger. Like, that was the university's response. And it was just, it was such a bizarre time. And my friend Ryan and I came at it from, we loved languages. I really love languages. But we wanted to do something where people could connect with each other and not do it in this sort of really, you know, stiff, this is the classroom learning environment, or, you know, broad, hey, this is International Culture Day, come eat foods. And, you know, which is still nice. And it is, has a very important place. But we're like, why don't we who know different languages teach other people languages, but in a way that they can actually talk them? And it was just like, I mean, I could talk about this forever, but because I really like languages, it really became a force. Like, we started with 100 people. It was students and teachers, and teachers were just doing this for free. And we just had like conversation classes, essentially, at any level. We just wanted people to be able to talk to each other and connect and learn like colloquialisms and, you know, like funny jokes and things that are really common for your culture or your, you know, a specific language. And lo and behold, like, our Farsi classes were the most popular. And when we expanded the next year, we like tripled like who we had, and all the Farsi classes were packed. Like, there's a power in connecting people and including people and in trying to, you know, fight against the tide of like, you are different from me. Like, yes, we are different, but we share so much. Like, we can have so much in common. And I kept on trying to do that in my PhD. You know, you mentioned the Minority Graduate Student Organization, which unfortunately doesn't exist anymore, but whose effects still last. Yeah, the diversity workshop that we started, you know, again, students developed it, right? It wasn't something that existed. And it was really one of the first in the nation for graduate schools, which is fascinating how terrible academia is.
We could have a whole conversation about that.
Yeah, I feel like we could all have another 10 podcasts about that.
Yep.
Anyway, so we built a diversity workshop. It was a great starting point. Our bar was like, let's have people come out of this knowing what is diversity. Like, that was how low the bar was. Like, you could just roll yourself over that bar. It was so low. But it was where to start. Like, you know, yes, we have differences. Yes, we look different, but we have all these things that are shared, or all these things that you shouldn't expect, you know, just when you look at me. That was really great. And then I resuscitated and took over the Women in Life Sciences group with a couple other graduate students. And that was meant to be like a, you know, how can we support women in science? Because much like in other STEM fields, you can have like 50-50 parity between men and women in graduate programs. But once you look at tenure track, you know, professor positions, it's dismal. And if you're any sort of intersection, like a person with a disability and a woman, or like a person of color and a woman, or just anything else, there's no statistics, essentially. Like, there's so few of us. And so I did this Women in Life Sciences, and as through running it, I heard just terrible things from people that were sharing what was happening in their labs. You know, I'd hear professors being like, that stuff was, you know, sexism is a thing of the 70s. Like, that's not a thing anymore. Like, we've come such a long way. It's not a problem. It's like, no, it still is. And I had done a lot of things, you know, from college through graduate school that were about retention and like building resources for people that were coming into graduate programs, into schools. It was frustrating because there were still no broad sweeping changes in our institutions that would really, you know, attack the inequities, really address why diversity is lacking in STEM. It would really, you know, really start to tackle the real, you know, ingrained systemic problems. And I went to this talk where one of the most respected professors at UCSF, she gave a talk, and she's brilliant. Her name is Dr. Carol Gross. She's fabulous. And she's done so much work to help women and minorities in science. It's amazing. But she presented some data on the status of women in science and in this big talk at UC Berkeley. And I asked the question, I was like, okay, so it still seems like we have really big problems. We need to make sweeping changes, right? So how would you go about doing that? I was ready for like, here's my 10-step plan. And her answer was like, it is so hard. She's like, I don't feel I have the clout to do this. She is so well established. Like, the reason I learned about UCSF was because I was in Japan, and a professor in Japan was like, this is the foremost person in microbiology. Go find her. She's amazing. Like, that, she's world recognized, she's respected, she's well loved, she's a team player. She's one of those few sorry, academics. He's one of those few academics that actually wants to play as a team and does a fantastic job doing science with that. And so here she was telling me that she didn't feel she had enough clout and that it's better to make small changes. And I was gutted. I was like, no way. Like, we need something different. Like, this, if I stay in academia, this is, I would never see change until like 15 years, 30 years later. I would probably be in the same boat she is, saying I don't have enough clout. So I needed something different. At the same time, you know, like a week later or something, I went to a conference on solutions to bias, and Kat Adams was there. She's UBP's co-founder. She really like nucleated this idea of like, let's use the science that's out there. Sociologists have studied this discrimination for years, decades even, and they've thought about this, but we need to translate those, you know, academic solutions into something that anybody can use, right? Because it doesn't matter if it's unconscious or overt bias, like the tools are really the same of like what you need to do about it. Together, we were just like, you know, we're tired of the complaints. We're tired of doing this, like, you know, just putting a Band-Aid over the problem when like it's really a hemorrhage, right? this is a huge problem. It's really broad. It's really big. And we have to give people actionable, like easy to apply tools and techniques and words that they can describe the problems. You know, like, I didn't even know how to describe unconscious bias until I started talking with Kat. And at this time, we were a student org at Berkeley, and I realized like, oh. So that moment when my professor was like, you know, I don't think your science is good enough to take to a conference. Like, that's actually his unconscious bias speaking, because you talk to that professor and he's like, oh, he's on every board, on every like pro diversity, pro inclusion thing. Anywhere, like, he, you know, that is his motto, his thing. But if you looked at his track record, only men were being invited to go to conferences. I didn't realize that, because I was like, oh yeah, my science is terrible, right? Like, that's what we're taught as academics to do, is like, oh, self-doubt, it's baked in. And you know, and I didn't know that was how to define that, like the awkward feeling when, you know, somebody like repeats the idea that you just had and they get the credit for it. You know, that's all coming from bias and unconscious bias and sort of these ingrained things. So with Kat, we're like, okay, we want to disrupt this. We want to make this different. We don't want it to be a dry, you know, boring workshop. We don't want it to be a guilt fest, right? Cause that's the other way people talk about this. We want this to make people feel like they can do something about it. Like, not sit there in the vast, like, oh my God, this is a huge problem and I will never be able to do a single thing about this, and change that and be like, hey, you know, I can have guilt. I can process, like, I might have hurt somebody in the past, and I can do something, right? I can change what I do. And it can be just a tiny different step, like, you know, listening to a podcast on linguistic discrimination, watching a TV show that isn't an entirely white, cis-het, able-bodied cast. You know, there's just tiny differences in your actions that you can make. It's a butterfly effect. It's a huge ripple effect, and that's really powerful. And that's why Kat and I have stuck together through thick and thin. Of our group, we started the nonprofit to, because people, once we developed a workshop, people were like, can I throw you some money? We're like, wait, we're not ready for that. So we started the nonprofit. We're like, okay, well, let's make this intentional. Let's build these things. Let's get the stuff out there. And let's get professionals like Lucrecia, you know, on board to, you know, that have this, you know, additional brilliant expertise in how to talk to CEOs in like Palo Alto, right? Like, we don't have that, but, you know, folks like Lucrecia do.
It's a mixture, professional, personal, and the more I work, of course, the more I learn about myself and about the in-group community, and I get in and out myself. So it is all a process, very subtle process for me and for my clients. So the first thing, and this is a little bit hard for me to be talking as a professional and talking as a human being at this very moment, because I was searching for my clients the other piece, right? I work with decoding, changing behaviors, deconstructing, trying for the people to find their own self-conscious and self-awareness and self-knowledge. So we work, and executive coaches, we work a little bit with neuroscience. I am particularly working a lot with neuroscience. I study with the best PhD about it. So I was able to change behaviors, but I was not really having a lot of answers. And this is where my personal story gets in, because as being a foreigner, I always need to be with the best to prove myself. So instead of stopping there, like, well, I don't really care what is the science and what is the data about this particular situation or behavior or thought, I start talking a lot with the diversity, equity, and inclusion people. And believe it or not, they didn't give me a lot of answers. So one of my mentors said, well, you need to really talk to these doctors in Berkeley. They have the other half of what you're looking for. So immediately I call them and say, I want to learn from you, and I think I have the practicum of what you're teaching in the long term. So you facilitate, and I take hands to the people for a few more months. So I really make sure that the change is happening. And I'm really sure that they really understand in practice what you teach and what you facilitate. So I fall in love with them. And of course, again, personally and professionally, it was like a bomb.
You say it was like a bomb? Can you explain a little?
This is part of the personal thing, right? I'm from Spain. I'm from Madrid. I was part of the elite. Nobody was thinking about, is she intelligent enough? Is she good enough? Nobody really questioned my money or my position or my privilege. When I came here, I was really comfortable because people are doing different things at the same time, and it's appropriate and it's cool, and you know what you do with your time and your talent. So it was kind of the perfect fit, but I start realizing, but you are a minority here. You don't really realize that. I am not considered myself Latina in anyone in Europe, right? But at the same time, here I'm part of Latino group. So I was having that debate in my own body and in my own brain. And I don't look like the Latino than you think. I don't. I look more European, the European than you think. And my Spanish is way different, right, than the other Spanish. So I was like, why should I be in this group? And I don't even feel part of this group. So the bomb was when I realized, wow, Lynette is also feeling that, because she's also part of the world, not really part of this group of the Unconscious Bias Project in Berkeley or the doctors and PhD. So my whole body was very relaxed, and my whole body understood at that time when I talked to Kat at the same time that Lynette, those are my people. They have intellect, they have hearts, and they feel that they are part of everywhere and nowhere. So that's kind of the description of the bomb.
Perhaps because of confidentiality, you can't tell us who you work with, but can you tell us a little bit about projects that the Unconscious Bias Project has been doing?
The Unconscious Bias Project, our main offering are workshops. And so we have like really, you know, compacted hour and a half interactive, empowering workshops where we give you everything from a 101 on like, what is bias? What is unconscious bias? How do I know if I have it? You know, what can I start doing about my personal bias? What can I do to intervene in moments of bias? And then like, depending on who our client is, we'll put in a piece about power dynamics, which is very important aspect of all this, or something about policy, for example, or if you're a teacher, you know, how does this show up in classrooms? That's one thing that we've done. Another project that we've been recently working with the Student Org and with UC Berkeley campus is to create like an awareness campaign about unconscious bias and what you can do about it using art. So we've worked with local artists to create a gamified version of what it's like to go through life with intersectional biases. We called it the dastardly dark way, where you have to like, you know, contort your body through, you know, a dark hallway. Well, you had the same thing except with yarn, which is cute. And you have like a buzzer at the end, but we give you all these props that are meant to represent like the barriers people face, you know, going through life with, you know, whatever identity other people place on them or identity that they have. We were able to run this before pandemic. And it was really great. You know, we're getting people, you know, saying like, well, I tripped over a bunch of yarn, but it wasn't my fault. It's because I had these, you know, this huge ball as part of my character that, you know, randomly got assigned. It's like, well, yeah, your character was somebody with obesity due to a metabolic disorder. Like it wasn't their choice, right, to have to carry the stereotype of, you know, being stereotyped for being fat, but they still had to deal with that through their lives. So this is that representation. Like we're literally talking about what bias means, right? Even if it's a game, even, you know, people are actually, you know, having these conversations. People love our workshops. We're very, very fortunate to have people really receive them well, but they're always optional workshops. You know, if you force somebody to do training, whether it's sexual harassment or diversity or whatever, it's more likely than not going to backfire. Like there's actually a Harvard Business Review study examining why do diversity programs fail. And this is one of the main ones. So how do we get the people that like really should be thinking about this stuff to learn about this stuff? And this is where the awareness campaign came in. So we made the Dastardly Dark Way. We also have an interactive art installation where we have our amazing cartoonist, Teresa Oborn, illustrate moments of bias that people have shared with us. And people get to interact with the art piece and say like, yeah, I've seen this before, or this has happened to me, or this is the first time I'm seeing this and I didn't know it was bias. We also developed what we call the fun shop, which is a spin on a traditional workshop where you're creating art essentially at the same time that you're learning evidence-based bias reduction tools. We actually tried it out at the California Welfare Directors Association that we were talking about earlier, and it went super well. And so you're using social, emotional, and physical learning of creating, you know, a drawing or creating a bead bracelet or a keychain. But then you're also thinking about, you know, okay, this is what is unconscious bias. Here's how I'm applying a tool, like, for example, individuating instead of stereotyping is one of the tools. And we have people pair up with total strangers, and we give them a series of questions they can ask each other. You know, anything from like, hi, you know, my name is, this is where I'm from, to, you know, spicier questions, like, you know, this was the first time I was discriminated against, or you know, here is an identity of mine that you would not necessarily know just by looking at me. And it was really powerful. Like people came up to us and they were like, you know, this person that I thought I would have nothing in common with, we literally have the same life. Like we have the same job, you know, in totally different counties. We have, you know, this aged kids. We read the same book like last week, and we both like to knit, and we both like this type of music. It was like, I would not have planned that better. That moment of connection is really powerful. Unfortunately, with the pandemic, you know, we're put all of that on hold because we're, you know, all of our stuff has been in person. What we're actually embarking on right now, it's something that we just sort of started coming up with in the last few days, is we want to create a series of online either videos or podcasts. We're still figuring this out, to address the racism and xenophobia that is just flaring up throughout the U.S. and really internationally, against Chinese people and people of Asian descendants. You know, so this is Asian Americans, Asians, Chinese, Filipinos. It doesn't matter what country in Asia you might be from; like, you're getting it, and it's awful and it's terrible. I realized, like, hey, we are the Unconscious Bias Project. We have this experience. We have these tools. We've been in these conversations. Why don't we just put this out there and give it to people? Ideally, very bite-sized, you know, easy ways to digest, because, you know, it's a pandemic is unsettling. It's affecting all of us, and it's scary and it's hard. And it would be so hard to ask anybody to be like, okay, you are on Muni, you know, for whatever reason, you're on public transit, and you see somebody say something to someone who might be Chinese, like, you don't even know, right? That's something that's racist. What do you say? Like, it's already hard enough to speak up about this stuff without the pandemic, but you have all the stress and stuff on you. Why don't we break it down and make it easy? You know, like, this is what we do in our workshops. Let's figure out how to do it online. So we're going to roll this out ideally in April and May. It's becoming more and more apparent that some of these really deep inequities that we have in our healthcare systems, in our, you know, our welfare systems, all of these sort of infrastructures that are being impacted by the pandemic, I feel like the time is now. And we are a nonprofit, so we are going to have a fundraiser associated with it. We've never really done a ton of online content, so this will be new for us. And, you know, any amount is a really helpful amount. You know, it's a critical time right now. We cannot be permitting bias and discrimination to fester and continue the way it is, because we need to come together. We need to, yes, we have to be apart, right? 6 feet apart. We need to unite. We need to, you know, now is a time that we should be, saying something, that we should be listening to, you know, people with disabilities. Now is the time. You know, if you weren't before, like, now is the time to listen and learn and do something and intervene. Like, we have the power. We can do it. All it takes is just you know, one little step, one little phrase, one little, hey, hold on, that's uncalled for, or, you know, hey, that's not right.
I don't think that's an excellent place to end on. That's like such a good message. Yes.
Awesome. Yes.
Almost as if you're saying to not be an asshole.
Yes. Yeah. Please just don't be an asshole. Just. Yes. You only need one. You don't need to be two.
Oh, wow. My God. I love that.
Wow.
The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by me, Carrie Gillen, for Halftone Audio. Theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Vocal Fries Pod. You can email us at vocalfriespod@gmail.com, and our website is vocalfriespod.com.